Propagating tempeh spores. There are many different ways of propagating tempeh spores. As with all things tempeh, William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi's books have the most comprehensive information on propagating tempeh. In Indonesia, some tempeh is typically grown sandwiched between leaves of waru hibiscus trees, Hibiscus tiliaceus Linn. This tempeh is allowed to overripen, and the spores become bound in the hairy leaves, which are dried and used by mixing dehulled, cooked, and cooled beans by hand, holding a leaf, spore side out, in one hand. Any overripened sporulating tempeh can be used as a starter. But the more meticulous you can be, the purer the progeny. In the traditional context of mixed cultures, this wasn't an issue at all, because the tempeh community of fungi and bacteria had stability. In Indonesia, good quality mixed culture starter is prepared daily in thousands of neighborhood tempeh shops under extremely unsanitary conditions, point out Shurtleff and Aoyagi. In the context of pure culture tempeh, which is what most of us outside of Indonesia know, each generation presents the possibility of contamination by bacteria and weakening of the mold. To maintain a pure culture requires scrupulous and methodical effort. To be perfectly honest, I have had limited success in propagating tempeh starter. I have made a few good batches using methods described here. But more often, after a few days of incubation, other molds have started developing, especially sweet-smelling yellow aspergillus molds, which I have grown a lot in the same incubation space. Pure cultures are a challenge for a multicultural generalist. Sporulation, the reproductive phase of mold growth, occurs after mycelial growth. In tempeh, sporulation is marked by darkening color. As discussed, the dark patches that often develop on tempeh near air holes are signs of first sporulation. Higher oxygenation and drier conditions both promote sporulation. The easiest way to obtain spores is simply to overripen a batch of tempeh. To maximize spore production, expose as much surface area as possible. I do this by slicing myceliated bound tempeh into thin slices and leaving them in the incubator. Once they are bound, you can leave them with greater air exposure, thus encouraging both sporulation and drying. You can simply grind up your sporulated tempeh to use as starter, but then your next batch will have old, overripe soybean pieces mixed in with the fresh substrate, creating the potential for off flavors. The simplest way to extract spores from overripened tempeh is in water. Use non- or dechlorinated water. Crumble the sporulated tempeh into a jar and cover with water. Seal the jar and shake hard for a minute or two. The water will turn black as spores release into it. After this vigorous shaking, strain out solids and discard them. Leave the dark spore water still for about 15 minutes. The spores will sink to the bottom, appearing as a black sludge. Gently pour off the cloudy water, leaving just this sludge. This sludge is your new starter. The drawback of this method is that because the spores are wet, they are less stable than if dry, so you must use them within a few days. For longer storage, freeze the sporulated tempeh pieces and extract spores into water as needed. The best way to produce a quantity of tempeh spores is to grow them on a substrate of rice, cooked on the dry side, with less water than rice by volume, so it won't clump. So it can be effectively ground to a powder rather than a pulp, and so it will be more stable for storage. You get much less random bacterial presence in your starter if you sterilize your rice by steaming it under pressure. Random bacteria are not an issue when you make a batch of tempeh from starter, but if that level of contamination is perpetuated in successive generations, before too long, the rhizopus mold you are wishing to grow may no longer be dominant. For home or cottage industry production, scrupulous cleanliness and pressure cooking the rice are adequate for making tempeh starter. Producing starter for broader distribution requires a higher level of protection. For instance, inoculating the rice inside a protected chamber and microscopic inspection of each batch for quality control. These various levels of protection against contamination are thoroughly described in Shurtleff and Aoyagi's tempeh production. Here I will describe a method that has worked, with only moderate success, in my own modest-scale production. The method in a nutshell is 1. Soak rice in mason jars. 2. Pressure steam the rice right in the jars, covered with a coffee filter secured by a jar ring or rubber band. 3. Allow to cool slowly to body temperature. 4. Inoculate the rice with starter. 5. Incubate 4 to 7 days, monitoring the temperature and shaking a couple of times a day to prevent clumping. And 6. Grind into a powder in a blender that the mason jars can screw directly onto, or in a mortar with a pestle. Most of the literature recommends using white rice for making tempeh starter. I cannot find any discussion of why white rice is typically used rather than brown. I assume it is because the mold grows more quickly on white rice, since protective outer membranes have been removed. Betty Steckmeyer recalls seeing a scanning electron microscopic image of brown rice grains showing deeply convoluted surfaces. I imagine these grooves could harbor resistant bacterial and fungal spores, leading to starter contamination. Nonetheless, in my own experiments, I have had better results with brown rice because white rice has a greater propensity for clumping, which makes it difficult to grow the mold to sporulation on each individual grain. If you follow the conventional wisdom and use white rice, definitely stay away from rice coated with talc, magnesium silicate. Before you start, rinse the rice well until the rinse water runs clear to remove powdered starch from the surface. The scientists at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Northern Regional Research Laboratory conducted experiments to determine viable spore counts of rhizopus grown on different substrates at various moisture levels. This research determined that rhizopus grown on rice produces higher spore counts than when grown on wheat, wheat bran, or soybeans. It also determined that with white rice, the highest spore production occurred if the substrate was prepared at a ratio of 10 parts rice to 6 parts water. Shurtleff and Aoyagi report in Tempeh Production that a tempeh maker did further experiments and found that 10 parts rice to 5 parts water gave more abundant sporulation and, more important, easier pulverization in a blender with less drying. In terms of brown rice, Shurtleff and Aoyagi report that Australian investigator John McComb found that whole brown rice worked better than white rice, and that it worked best using 10 parts by weight of brown rice to 8 parts water. What these proportions translate to, in practical terms, is that 1/4 cup, 0.1 pound, or 50 grams, of rice, the quantity appropriate for a pint, 16-ounce or 500-milliliter jar, requires just under 3 tablespoons, 40 milliliters, of water for brown rice, or just under 2 tablespoons, 25 milliliters, for white rice. Note that at these proportions, the jar is mostly empty. This is necessary to be able to spread the rice in a fairly thin layer when the jar is laid on its side, so maximum surface area is exposed, encouraging maximum sporulation. If your pressure cooker is large enough to accommodate quart/liter jars elevated above the bottom of the pot, you can use those larger jars and double the quantity of all ingredients in each jar. I always do several jars at once. Working with brown rice, soak the rice overnight directly in the jar with the recommended quantity of water. With white rice, rinse the rice well first, drain, then soak for just about an hour, shaking periodically. Cover the jar with a coffee filter and secure with a screw-on ring, or alternatively a rubber band or string. Add a couple of inches of water to the pressure cooker, then improvise a rack to hold the jars above the water. Steam under pressure, approximately 15 pounds/100 kilopascal if your pressure cooker has a gauge. For brown rice, maintain the pressure for 40 minutes. For white rice, 20 minutes will suffice. After you remove the pressure cooker from the heat, leave it sealed and allow the pressure and temperature to reduce slowly. Once it has depressurized and cooled to body temperature, open the pressure cooker, remove the jars, and shake them vigorously to break up any clumps of rice. If the clumps will not break up from shaking, use a spoon or other implement, sterilized in boiling water, to reach into the jar and break up clumps as best you can. When the rice reaches body temperature, inoculate with starter, again using a sterilized implement. For 1/4 cup of rice, 1/8 teaspoon starter is sufficient. Use 1/4 teaspoon for 1/2 cup rice. Secure a coffee filter over the mouth of the jar, shake it in different directions to spread the starter in the rice, and lay the jars on their sides in the incubation chamber. Incubate, as for tempeh, in the range of 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, or 27 to 32 degrees Celsius. Instead of just 24 hours, as for typical tempeh, however, the starter requires several days of incubation, as long as 7 days with brown rice, to fully sporulate. Shake a few times each day to break up clumps. Once sporulated, grind rice using a blender, coffee grinder, or mortar and pestle. Whichever tool you use, sterilize it with boiling water, then allow it to dry and cool to minimize contamination of your starter. Use starter at a proportion of approximately 1 teaspoon for each pound or 500 grams of dry beans or grains you make into tempeh. With one exception, I have always worked with powdered tempeh starters commercially available in the United States, all derived from spores of Rhizopus oligosporus from the USDA's culture collection, where it is listed as strain NRRL2710, Rhizopus oligosporus cyto, with Keith Steinkraus credited as its source. Cyto is the name of the Japanese microbiologist who in 1905 first isolated Rhizopus oligosporus as the primary tempeh mold and named it. Tempeh variations. Chickpea tempeh. Ligusta yearwood, New Paltz, New York. Chickpea tempeh is 100% chickpeas. You can get a batch in the incubator in under 2 hours because the chickpeas cook so fast, and it tastes so mellow, perfect for people who don't usually like tempeh. Fava bean tempeh. Greg Barker, Berkeley, California. An ingredient I really love and highly recommend for tempeh is hulled dried fava beans. The flavor of favas is great. They compress down into an arrangement that makes for a good fungal mat. But the key is the time savings. I never had a mill/grinder or any way of getting the hulls off my soybeans. The hulled favas solve that, and they cook really quickly too, making the transition from soaked beans to inoculated cakes brief and only 15 minutes of labor. Dry roasted soybeans for tempeh. Betsy Shipley used to make tempeh commercially, then retired and posted this and many other innovative tempeh making ideas online. The easiest way to make our tempeh is to start with dry-roasted, non-GMO or organic soybean halves, unsalted. This saves you all the work involved in dehulling and cooking regular soybeans. Pour 24 ounces of soybean halves into boiling water. Remove from heat and let them sit for 24 to 48 hours. The beans will expand to twice the size, so use enough water. After pre-soaking the soybean halves, drain and refill with clean water, about an inch higher than the beans, and bring to a boil. The one exception was tempeh starter gifted to me some years ago by a fellow tempeh lover who had brought starter with him from Indonesia. This starter was a fine yellow powder, very different in appearance from the gray-black NRRL2710 strain. The tempeh it made was also distinctive, sweeter, and somehow more complex. I'm guessing the yellow starter was a more diverse mold mixture, incorporating aspergillus as well as rhizopus molds. After all traditional ferments are mixed cultures. I have read of other tempeh-like foods in which still other molds have been identified, such as Chinese meitouze, in which the substrate is the residual soybean solids, okara, from tofu manufacturing, and the mold that has been isolated is Actinomucor elegans. The isolated pure cultures that microbiology has facilitated are not what people have traditionally used. Traditional ferments are all mixed culture mutts, manifesting in varied and sometimes shifting forms. It's very exciting to see, taste, and work with different mixes. I welcome and encourage the informal spread of traditional cultures as possible. Unfortunately, casual importation of cultures is difficult and technically illegal in the name of public health and safety. Perhaps someone will do whatever paperwork is required to start importing other tempeh strains. In the meantime, work with what is available, which makes wonderful tempeh. Making koji. The other mold fermentation I have a lot of experience with is koji, the Japanese manifestation of chu, also traditionally a mixed culture but today typically grown as a single strain of fungus, Aspergillus oryzae. Before I started growing koji, I would never have believed it possible to fall in love with a mold. But I have been seduced by fresh koji's sweet fragrance as rapid mycelial growth generates heat from enzyme digestion of complex carbohydrates. I am not alone in my passion for this mold. Missouri fermentation enthusiast Allison Ewald writes, "I wish I had known that the aroma of rice inoculated with koji mold would put me under a spell from which I would never free myself and never wish to." Washington fermenter Favero Greenforest gushes, "The koji smelled so wonderful, I just want to roll around in it. Few things have a more delicious fragrance." You'll never know what we're all so excited about unless you grow some koji yourself. Koji itself is generally not eaten as a food, although it is delicious. Koji is the first step toward many elaborately processed foods and beverages. I have used koji to make miso, soy sauce, amazake, sake, and pickles. At the point when I wrote Wild Fermentation, and until about 2005, I had only used koji obtained from others, first the American Miso Company, and later South River Miso Company. Koji is not cheap, especially when I got to making 20 gallons, 75 liters, of miso, or more, a year. I knew spores of Aspergillus oryzae were readily available, but frankly, I was intimidated about maintaining incubation for as long as 48 hours, needlessly, as it turns out. Generally, to make koji, you need a starter. At the end of this section, I will describe how I was able to make koji from organisms spontaneously present on the husks of fresh corn, but I would certainly encourage you to try it at least once using a starter culture so you can experience the unique aroma of fresh-growing koji, because recognizing that distinctive smell is the most straightforward way you have to gauge whether you have the right mold growing if you try starting koji spontaneously using corn husks. The source I have used for koji starter is Gem Cultures, which sells several different koji starters for different substrates and, in the case of rice, different end products. Don't be overwhelmed by the choices. Just pick one to start with. Later, you can experiment with others. My favorite is barley koji, which I've used in miso, amazake, and pickles. But the process I'll describe is similar no matter the substrate on which you grow the koji. The basic process for koji is soak, steam, cool, inoculate, and incubate. The incubation is generally 36 to 48 hours. Soak the pearled barley overnight. Steam until cooked, about 2 hours. I use stacking Chinese bamboo steamers lined with a cotton cloth to keep the grains from falling through the bottoms. The barley steams into a sticky mass. Release the steamed barley from the steamer into a big bowl or pot. Break up the clumps and allow the barley to cool to body temperature. Meanwhile, heat an incubator to the 80 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 27 to 35 degrees Celsius temperature range. Line a baking pan or other wide open vessel with a clean, unscented cotton sheet or other smooth cloth folded in a couple of layers. Once the barley approaches body temperature, inoculate it with starter at whatever proportion is recommended by your source and stir thoroughly. Place inoculated barley into the cloth, arranging it as a mound in the center. Put a thermometer into the center of the mound and fold the sheet over the mound and around the thermometer, so you have a fabric-wrapped mound with a thermometer sticking out. Place the mound into the incubator and maintain the temperature in the range of 80 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 27 to 35 degrees Celsius. In general, the higher the temperature of cultivation of the mold, the greater the amylolytic activity, which converts starch to sugars, according to Steve Steinkraus. Lower temperatures of incubation favor development of proteases, which digest proteins. This suggests aiming for incubation temperatures at the top of the range for amazake or rice beverages, and lower temperatures for koji for miso or shoyu production. Monitor temperature periodically, and after about 16 hours, start peeking at the barley. By about 24 hours, you should find that the barley has a sweet fragrance, appears dusted with a chalky white mold growth, and is starting to clump together. Once these developments have occurred, the mold begins to generate heat, and your objective switches from keeping it warm enough to preventing it from overheating. Spread the mound of barley out into an even layer no more than 2 inches, 5 centimeters, thick. This is important because if the koji mat is too thick, heat can accumulate in the center and kill the mold. If the pan holding your koji is too small, use a cookie sheet or divide it into 2 baking pans. Improvise as necessary. To further modulate temperature, run your fingers over the koji like a rake and leave it with furrows, which increase surface area for releasing heat. Cover the koji with a cloth and return to the incubator. Keep checking the koji every few hours. Stick your clean hands right into it. Find clumps and break them up. Spread out barley from hot spots. Re-level, re-furrow, re-wrap, and return to incubator. Enjoy the seductive aroma of the developing koji as you work with it. As koji develops, the white mold growth will increase and cover each grain. You can use your koji once grains appear to be covered with mold growth. Definitely stop incubating koji if you begin to notice yellow-green patches on the surface, indicating that sporulation has begun. You can add fresh warm koji directly into your miso, amazake, or sake project. Whatever you are not using right away, spread out in a thin layer to cool to room temperature, then wrap and refrigerate. For longer storage, dry koji briefly in the sun or a dehydrator before storing. To grow koji on rice, at present GEM sells two different strains, which confuses some people. Their light rice koji is for making amazake, sake, pickles, or some kinds of miso. Their red rice koji, not to be confused with Chinese red rice mold, ang kak, similar to koji but with another mold, Monascus purpureus, is used for red misos. GEM's directions for both recommend using polished rice, which is white rice. I've also had fine results using brown rice. If you use white rice, be sure to avoid rice with talc added. And rinse the rice well to remove loose surface starch. In addition, after soaking and before steaming, let the rice drain in the colander for several minutes. The less surface water remains, the less the grains of rice will fuse together during cooking. You can even drain directly onto an absorbent towel for a few more minutes, or aim a fan at the rice and stir. The added drying will aid in keeping the cooked rice lump-free, explains Betty Steckmeyer, whose step-by-step instructions that come with all the GEM cultures are clear and detailed. Brown rice does not fuse together like white rice does, so no need to be quite so meticulous. Growing koji on soybeans is essentially the same as for barley. Steaming takes much longer, as long as 6 hours if not under pressure. Use a pressure cooker to steam soybeans if you can, because it only requires about an hour and a half. Soybeans should be soft enough to easily crush between your fingers. Temperatures need to be monitored very carefully during fermentation because the soybeans' high protein content makes them highly susceptible to Bacillus subtilis at temperatures above 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 35 degrees Celsius. The mold does not smell quite as sweet with soybeans, but it is still a pleasant aroma, especially when it's incubated with roasted wheat for shoyu. To propagate koji starter, or tane koji, literally seed koji, use brown rice. White rice is not used in making starter, since it lacks the necessary nutrients to support optimal growth of the molds, explain Shurtleff and Aoyagi. Soak rice, drain well, steam, and cool as described earlier. When rice is cooled to body temperature, before inoculating, mix in sifted hardwood ashes, about 1.5% by weight of the quantity of dry rice you cooked. The ash provides potassium, magnesium, and other trace elements that promote healthy mold growth and sporulation. Inoculate with starter and incubate at a slightly cooler temperature than is typically used for growing koji, about 79 degrees Fahrenheit or 26 degrees Celsius. Mound the rice for the first 24 hours, then mix it and remound for another 24 hours. After about 48 hours, spread into an even layer wrapped in cotton as described earlier. Leave the koji undisturbed, incubating at about 79 degrees Fahrenheit or 26 degrees Celsius for another 48 hours. By now, the koji should be covered with olive-green growth. Break up clumps and dry in the oven with the pilot or dehydrator at around 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 degrees Celsius. Store dry starter in a refrigerator or other cool, dark spot. Starter may be used as whole grains or ground into meal. Spores can also be extracted from grains by sifting, then mixing with flour. This process for making koji starter comes from Shurtleff and Aoyagi's book, Miso Production, which devotes a chapter to the topic and explains it in considerably more detail. Amazake. Amazake is a Japanese sweet rice porridge, pudding, or beverage made by fermenting rice or other grains with koji. Amazake is essentially the first step of making sake or other rice-based alcoholic beverages. Shurtleff and Aoyagi translate amazake as sweet sake, and Elizabeth Ando reports that it is also known as hitoya zake, or one-night rice wine. I include amazake here rather than in the grain chapter to draw attention to an important concept with koji, which is that it is typically used in ferments as a source of enzymes rather than for the continued mycelial growth of the mold itself. As we have just seen, growing mold requires oxygen and is temperature sensitive, with the mold prone to dying off at prolonged exposure to temperatures much above body temperature. The enzymes the mold produces, however, do not share the same environmental requirements. These enzymes do not require oxygen, and some actually work most efficiently at higher temperatures. Amazake uses the same ingredients as koji, almost exactly. They both are rice, or another grain, cooked and then inoculated with the mold Aspergillus oryzae. The only differences are the phases of life of the aorizae introduced and how the environment is maintained. Making koji, you add the mold in its spore stage and encourage it with moist but not wet conditions, moderately warm temperatures, and limited air circulation. To make amazake, you use a mold that already has grown. Mix it with freshly cooked rice that can be still quite hot, 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius, in a jar or crock and try to keep it as warm as possible. With a good proportion of fresh koji and warm temperatures, the koji enzymes are vigorously active. I was first introduced to making amazake by Aveline Kushi, the wife of macrobiotics popularizer Michio Kushi, whose Complete Guide to Macrobiotic Cooking has a number of ferments in it and guided some of my earliest experiments. Kushi recommends 1/2 cup, 125 milliliters, of koji for 4 cups or 1 liter uncooked rice. And for years I made occasional amazake, which I liked, following these proportions. She recommends using sweet brown rice, overnight soaking, and pressure cooking without salt. When cool enough to handle, mix the koji into the rice with your hands. Then transfer the mixture to a glass bowl, do not use metal, cover with a wet cloth or towel, and place near an oven, radiator, or any other warm place. Allow to ferment 4 to 8 hours. During the fermentation period, occasionally stir the mixture to melt the koji. After fermenting, put the amazake in a pot and bring to a boil. When bubbles appear, turn off the heat. The proportions of koji to rice recommended by different sources vary dramatically. Kushi recommends 1/2 cup koji for 4 cups uncooked rice, a 1-to-8 ratio, while Shurtleff and Aoyagi suggest 2 cups of koji for each cup of rice, 2-to-1, as does Bill Mollison in his Ferment and Human Nutrition. Finally, after years of fretting about what proportions to use, I conducted a controlled experiment with the help of intern Mallory Foster. We cooked 6 cups of rice and placed equal portions of it in each of 6 jars. In 2 of the jars, we mixed 2 cups of koji, 2-to-1. In 2 of them, 1 cup koji, 1-to-1. And in 2 of them, 1/2 cup koji, 1-to-2. We took 1 jar of each proportion and incubated it at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius. The other jar of each proportion we incubated at about 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius. All the jars developed amazake, but at very different rates. After 12 hours, all the jars incubated at 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius were sweet. The 2-to-1 batch was vigorously bubbly, almost completely liquefied, and extremely sweet. The 1-to-1 batch was sweet and liquefied, but somewhat less so. And the 1-to-2 batch was still sweet and liquefied, only even less so. The jars incubated at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius, even at 2-to-1, were barely sweet. After 15 hours, the 1-to-1 batch at 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius was fully sweetened and liquefied. The 1-to-2 batch was sweeter, but still not there, and the jars incubating at the lower temperature were still barely sweet. At 21 hours, we judged all the warmer incubation jars ready. Of the 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius incubation batches, the 2-to-1 and 1-to-1 batches were good and sweet, with most of the rice liquefied, while the 1-to-2 batch was just starting to get sweet and its rice was still intact. The following day, that final batch had begun to sour. The lesson of this exercise for me was that incubation temperature is more important than proportion of koji, but that more koji enables the process to go faster. This makes sense because enzymes render their transformations repeatedly if not destroyed by excessive heat. If the process is too slow, through a combination of low incubation temperature and or low proportion of koji, then maximum sweetness is never achieved because souring begins before all the starch is converted to sugars. If you have enough koji to make amazake at a 2-to-1 ratio, I would certainly recommend that. If koji is scarce and you wish to use it at lower proportions, then be sure to incubate as close as possible to 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius. When you judge your amazake to be ready, stop fermentation or it will continue to ferment into acids and alcohol. Bring to a boil with a little water and a pinch of salt. Store amazake in the refrigerator. To use as a beverage, add 1 part amazake to 1 part water. Add ginger or other flavorings. Eric Haas recommends adding sake and or sake lees to amazake, simmered for a little while. They make a great combination. Undiluted, enjoy amazake as a pudding or as a sweetener in baking. Shurtleff and Aoyagi recommend substituting 3.5 units of amazake for 2 units of sugar or 1 unit of honey. Plant sources of mold cultures. Obviously, people have not always had pure culture spore powders available to them as starters. These traditional Asian mold cultures, like virtually all cultures used in fermentation, have their sources in plants. Quality alcoholic beverages produced by the traditional indigenous flora will probably never be equaled by the use of pure cultures, write Zhu Ganrong and Bao Tongfa of Jiangnan University in China in their grandiose survey of Chinese alcoholic drinks and beverages. Botanical ingredients are used not exclusively to start the fermentation, but also to impart flavors and additional intoxicating qualities. H.T. Huang includes several methods for making chu from ancient Chinese documents in his History of Chinese Fermentation. From the Qi Men Yao Shu, or Important Arts for the People's Welfare, written by Jia Cixi in the year 544, Huang translates the following description for preparation of qinzhao, common ferment, from wheat using leaves of artemisia, which could be mugwort, wormwood, or some other member of that large botanical genus. The process should start in the 7th moon, usually August. Take good, clean wheat free from insects and stir roast it in a large pot. The fire should be slow as the wheat is stirred rapidly with a rocking motion. The stirring should not be stopped even for a moment, otherwise the grains will not be cooked evenly. The wheat is roasted until it turns yellow and has a fragrant smell. It should not be singed. When done, it is winnowed and any extraneous matter removed. The wheat is then ground, but not too fine or too coarse. A few days before the start of the process, artemisia plants are collected and cleaned. The weed-free artemisia is dried in the sun until the water content is low. The raw ferment is prepared by mixing the ground wheat evenly with water. It should be firm, dry, and not sticky to the touch. When done, it is stored overnight and then kneaded further the next morning until the right consistency is achieved. A wooden mold is used to press the cakes. Each cake is 1 foot square and 2 inches thick. Strong young men are employed to press the cakes firmly. After pressing, a hole is pierced through the center of each cake. Shelves of bamboo slats are set up on a wooden frame. Dried artemisia leaves are laid on top of the shelves. The raw ferment cakes are laid on top of the artemisia and then covered with a layer of artemisia. The layer of artemisia on the bottom should be thicker than that on top of the ferment cakes. The door and windows of the hut are then closed and sealed. After the 3rd 7-day period, total of 21 days, the ferment cakes should be fully cured. The door is opened and the ferment cakes examined. If there are fine-colored mycelia on the surface, the cakes are taken out and dried in the sun. If no mycelia are seen, the door is resealed and the cakes allowed to incubate for another 3 to 5 days. They are then dried in the sun. During drying, the cakes are turned over several times. When fully dried, they are stacked on racks and stored until use. 1 tao of this type of ferment will digest 7 tao of grain after it is cooked. In light of what we know today, we can see that his directions are, on the whole, scientifically sound, concludes Huang, who reports that it is now common practice to inoculate the cooked substrates with ferment powder before incubation. In other words, backslopping. Across Asia, however, people continue to incorporate common local botanical ingredients into chu like starters, so they tend to be somewhat geographically specific. Ragi, an Indonesian starter, is made by mixing rice flour with pieces of ginger root, galangal roots, sugar cane, and other spices. The exact additives vary with the manufacturer, notes Steinkraus. The mixture is moistened with water or alternatively sugarcane juice and inoculated with dry powdered ragi from previous batches. The cakes, which may be 3 centimeters, 1.2 inches, in diameter and 0.5 to 1 centimeter, less than 1/2 inch, thick when flattened, are placed on a bamboo tray and incubated for several days at ambient temperature, followed by dehydration to preserve the cakes until needed. The air or sun-dried ragi cakes preserve the essential microorganisms for several months at room temperature in the tropics. In Nepal, where marcha is the traditional starter, the plants are different, but the method is very similar. My friend Justin Bullard, who first told me about marcha after his return from a year living in Nepal a decade ago, traveled there again in 2011 to investigate marcha making. I had the preconceived idea that the product was made from a single plant, so I was expecting Myla, who, with his wife, Didi, was showing Justin the process, to show me that single plant. But he ended up showing me two plants, and then later he and his wife began assembling 11 more plant ingredients to make the matcha. The botanical ingredients included banana leaves and peels, sugarcane leaves, young pineapple leaves, ginger root, hot pepper flakes and leaves, among others, as well as old matcha from a previous batch. This particular recipe for matcha had been passed to Didi from her mother and grandmother, and may be considered to be Magar in origin, Justin writes. Yet, as with many homemade concoctions in Nepal, there are rarely precise measurements for ingredients. The individual making the concoction often just eyeballs or samples the mixture and determines, based on experience or exposure to the process, if a certain amount of a given ingredient needs to be added or subtracted. In other instances, some ingredients are omitted because of lack of availability. Botanical ingredients are pulverized and mixed with millet flour and just enough water to bind the ingredients into a coarse dough. Cakes, a bit smaller than the size of the palm, about 3 to 4 ounces, are then shaped from the dough. If the cakes are too large, they will not dry properly. A matcha cake from a previous batch is broken up, and then each new matcha cake is swathed in the powder of the old cake and laid out on a dried grass mat away from the sun and covered with layers. This seems to keep the cakes warm and insulated. This is said to help facilitate the new matcha cakes to flower or ripen. Day 2, provided that the weather is hot and dry, the matcha cakes are uncovered and set in the sun to dry for a couple of hours on a flat woven basket. When asked how one knows when the cakes are ready to set out in the sun or have ripened, I was told that they will have an odor, and in fact, the cakes smelled yeasty, like bread dough. In addition, the cakes were covered in a very fine mildew. When Myla took the grass mat layers off the cakes, I could see they were covered in gossamer webs of must, and the odor was quite discernible. Hence the term phul cha, or flowered. After the cakes had set in the sun, they were replaced under the mats again under the porch. Day 3, the cakes were placed out in the sun again to dry. It was explained that the drying process could proceed in this fashion up to 5 days or more, and that gradually the color of the cakes would whiten in the sun. Then these would be stored and used at a later date. Elsewhere in the Himalayas, in the Tuns Valley, a starter for rice beverages called keem incorporates 42 different plants, including cannabis, cinnamon, and datura. I learned about keem from the Database on Microbial Traditional Knowledge of India, created by Dr. S. Sikar of Bharathidasan University in Tamil Nadu, India. According to Dr. Sikar, chopped fresh twigs of Cannabis sativa, 8 kilograms, 5 kilograms leaves of Sapindus mucorosi, soapnut, and 10 to 15 kilograms in total of different plant species are dried in the shade and powdered. The powder prepared from the plants is mixed with about 50 kilograms of barley flour. This dry mixture is moistened by an herbal infusion called jayaras. Together, they are mixed into dough and formed into small cakes. The cakes so formed are further processed by placing them on plant bed, locally called sethar, made up of tender shoots of Cannabis sativa and Pinus roxburghii, pine, alternately between the cakes in a closed room. The whole setup is allowed to remain undisturbed for 24 days. On the 25th day, the room is opened and the cake is put upside down and allowed to remain there for another 12 days. The cakes are then taken out and allowed to dry in the sun or open air. When the cakes dry up, they are ready for use as starter. The investigators who collected the data on keem production report that the plants used for this purpose vary slightly from place to place. During the course of this study, the authors came across people who disclosed that their forefathers used several more plants for this process. However, nobody could identify or name all of them. The botanical components of these starter cultures is important ethnobotanical information that is rapidly disappearing. You can make koji without starter using appropriate plant material as the microbial source, in this case, fresh corn husks. Steam rice, barley, or other grains as described earlier, only instead of inoculating and mounding in fabric, form into small, 2-inch or 5-centimeter, balls, and wrap the balls individually in fresh corn husks. Bind the wrapped balls with cord and hang or place on a breathable rack. Maintain at incubation temperatures of 80 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit or 27 to 35 degrees Celsius. I've done this best in hot, humid summer weather outside under the eaves. Of course, there are always exceptions, and some mixed culture fermentation starters are made with neither botanical ingredients beyond the grain substrate, nor backslopping from a mature batch, relying on organisms present on the substrate and/or in the aging environment. Korean Nuruk is made from coarsely ground wheat, moistened, kneaded, and shaped into large cakes, roughly 4 to 12 inches or 10 to 30 centimeters in diameter and 2 inches or 5 centimeters thick. Traditionally, no inoculum has been used, although in contemporary production, spores of Aspergillus ursamii are often introduced. These cakes are then incubated for 10 days in the temperature range of 86 to 113 degrees Fahrenheit, or 30 to 45 degrees Celsius, followed by 7 days in the narrower range of 95 to 104 degrees Fahrenheit, or 35 to 40 degrees Celsius, then dried for 2 weeks at 86 to 95 degrees Fahrenheit, or 30 to 35 degrees Celsius, and aged for 1 or 2 more months at ambient temperatures. Troubleshooting. Mold not visible and beans not bound on tempeh. The mold failed to grow. Perhaps the starter was not viable. Perhaps the beans were still too hot when the starter was introduced. Perhaps the incubation chamber was too hot or too cool for the mold to develop. Tempeh feels slimy. A slimy coating on the tempeh suggests that the tempeh overheated during incubation. Once the mold becomes established and starts to grow rapidly, it generates significant heat. It is possible for the heat that the mold growth generates to kill the mold, especially if the blocks of tempeh are thick, if there is limited ventilation in the incubation chamber, or if a large batch of tempeh is crowded in a small incubation chamber. Viable spores of the extremely heat-tolerant bacteria Bacillus subtilis are generally present on the tempeh substrates, even after cooking. While the tempeh mold is growing, it prevents B. subtilis from developing. However, if the tempeh mold is destroyed by excessive heat, the B. subtilis is at the ready and starts to develop with its telltale slimy coating and distinctive aroma. This does not make the tempeh dangerous, but it does result in poorly bound tempeh with a sharp flavor. When this has happened to me, I make the tempeh grade B and crumble it into heavily seasoned chili and sloppy joe type dishes. Tempeh turns black. When the tempeh mold first becomes visible, as its mycelia bind the beans and grains together, it is white. After about 24 hours of growth, the mold begins to develop darker patches of gray-black, indicating the beginning of sporulation. In a plastic bag with holes poked in it, sporulation begins near the holes, where the mold has the greatest access to oxygen. In an open tray system, the entire surface can begin to darken. The early stages of sporulation are typically the sign that the tempeh has incubated long enough and is ready to eat. If the tempeh is not removed from the incubator, sporulation will continue, and with it, stronger smell and flavor. In Java, this overripened tempeh, called tempeh busuk, is considered a delicacy in its own right. Tempeh smells like ammonia. In the first 24 hours of mold growth, the tempeh smells fresh and earthy. When the mold continues to develop and over-ripens, as described above, tempeh develops an ammonia smell. Or, in the appreciative words of William Shurtleff and Akiko Aoyagi, a penetrating over-ripe aroma remarkably like that of fine camembert cheese, and its texture softens to a slightly creamy lusciousness that must be tasted to be understood. Don't be afraid to try over-ripe tempeh. Mold fails to grow on koji. Perhaps the starter was not viable. Perhaps the grains were still too hot when the starter was introduced. Perhaps the incubation chamber was too hot or too cool for the mold to develop. Koji feels slimy. A slimy coating on the koji suggests that it overheated during incubation. Once the mold becomes established and starts to grow rapidly, it generates significant heat. It is possible for the heat that the mold growth generates to kill the mold, especially if the inoculated substrate is in a thick layer, if there is limited ventilation in the incubation chamber, or if a large batch of koji is crowded in a small incubation chamber. Viable spores of the extremely heat-tolerant bacteria Bacillus subtilis are generally present on the koji substrates, even after cooking. While the koji mold is growing, it prevents B. subtilis from developing. However, if the koji mold is destroyed by excessive heat, the B. subtilis is at the ready and starts to develop with its telltale slimy coating and distinctive aroma. If this happens, do not try to use the koji in further fermentation projects. Discard. Koji turns yellow-green. When the Koji mold first becomes visible, as its mycelia bind the substrate into clumps, it is white. After 36 to 48 hours of growth, the mold begins to develop patches of yellow-green, indicating the beginning of sporulation. For most applications, the earliest signs of sporulation are typically the cue that the Koji has incubated long enough and is ready to use. If the Koji is not removed from the incubator and cooled, sporulation will continue. For certain applications, such as Hamanato, yellow-green sporulated Koji is preferred. Keep a close watch on your developing Koji in the later part of the process so you can stop incubation at the appropriate time to obtain the type of Koji you need. Rice does not sweeten or liquefy in Amazake. Perhaps the Koji you added was not viable. Perhaps the rice was hotter than 140 degrees Fahrenheit or 60 degrees Celsius when you introduced the Koji, in which case the Koji enzymes were destroyed by heat. Perhaps you didn't add enough Koji or incubated it at too low a temperature. If this is the case, you can mix in more Koji and create a warmer incubation chamber. Amazake sours. This suggests that the rice was left incubating too long. Once the Koji enzymes sweeten the rice, lactic acid bacteria and yeasts start to ferment the sugars into acids and alcohol. Amazake needs to be harvested after its fermentation. Typically, it is then brought to a boil to kill the organisms poised to ferment it into something else.